This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. 53 years ago, Malcolm X was assassinated while giving a speech at the Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan. The Smithsonian Channel's latest in its series, The Lost Tapes, explores the rise of Malcolm X and the conflict surrounding his death. It uses rarely seen footage of the activist, along with some of his more well-known speeches.
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you?
That was from the new Smithsonian documentary, The Lost Tapes, Malcolm X. We'll hear more from the documentary and more about Malcolm X's life and legacy in just a minute.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel, one of the world's leading language apps. Learn to confidently speak a new language with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Choose from 14 languages like Spanish, French, or German. You'll learn your new language through fun, real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers and quizzes. Get started by going to Babbel, Babbel.com/1A, and use code 1A to get 50% off your first 6 months.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Joining us from KERA Public Radio in Dallas to discuss it is the documentary's producer, Tom Jennings. Tom, welcome to the program.
Joshua, thanks for having me.
Also with us from NPR in New York to discuss Malcolm X's life and legacy is Herb Boyd, the co-editor of The Diary of Malcolm X, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, 1964. Herb, glad to have you back on the program.
Oh, thank you, Josh.
Also with us from NPR West near Los Angeles is Marcus Hunter, chair of African American Studies at UCLA and the co-author of Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. Marcus, glad to have you with us.
Happy New Year, Joshua.
Tom, how did this program come about?
Well, we do a series for the Smithsonian Channel called The Lost Tapes, and it's a bit unique in that it has no, each of the programs has no narration and no interviews. We rely solely on the archive, the media available at the time, whether it's television, radio, still photographs. And we put it together in a way that it plays like a movie. It's like archive as a movie. Everything makes sense. It's a big jigsaw puzzle that we put together. And the network about a year ago said, what do you think about Malcolm X? And I said, I think Malcolm X is an excellent choice. And sure enough, we went out and we found obviously really well-known material, but we found some lesser-known material, and it's an amazing story.
Yeah, give us a sense of what kind of materials are in this documentary. There's no narration, by the way. It's done through kind of titles on screen and then clips of a video, but there's quite a mix of things that people might have seen at the time and then lesser available materials.
Mm-hmm. That clip you played comes from Los Angeles in 1962, for example. It's obviously better known. Malcolm traveled to Los Angeles after a gentleman named Ronald Stokes was shot and killed by the LAPD outside of a mosque, Mosque Number 27 in Los Angeles. So you're going to see parts of that. And, you know, one thing I want to emphasize is that you see a lot of material all at once. Whereas when you have experts talking about what things were like, or if you have a narrator explaining what's going on, it often gets in the way of actually hearing the, authentic material. So in our case, that speech, for example, and several others, lesser known too, instead of hearing 10 or 12 seconds, you get to hear 2 or 3 minutes. And so the context becomes, it absorbs the audience more. It's meant to be interactive instead of just images hitting your eyeballs.
A number of you have shared stories with us about getting to know the legacy of Malcolm X. Ronald emailed, "I, like many African Americans, were only taught about Malcolm X in passing, even in predominantly black schools and communities. I was taught to have an appreciation for history, but found that in public schools, conventional literature, and television, history is limited to an extent. Reading his biography in high school saved me." The bio also got the attention of Joe, who emailed, "I am a white male in my 50s. The Malcolm X Alex Haley autobiography was the most important book I have ever read to educate myself on race relations. He has been unfairly portrayed in the media." Herb Boyd, what about that? Malcolm X did have a chance to tell his story in the autobiography with Alex Haley. Millions of people have seen the film with Denzel Washington, the epic film by Spike Lee. With all of that, what do you think is the biggest gap, absent the lost tapes, but the biggest gap in the public understanding of Malcolm X, as you see it?
Well, I think one of the things we have to understand is so much depends on when and where you enter. Obviously, I entered a long time ago, so a lot of what we know and hear about Malcolm, and of course, even with the lost tapes, is not absolutely new or unfamiliar for me. Because, see, Malcolm spoke so often and pretty much along the same themes that you didn't necessarily have to have one speech to encapsulate, you know, that particular idea. For example, Ballad of the Bullets, he gave that speech three or four times. Message to the Grassroots, I heard three or four times. So it so much depends, you know, Joshua, in terms of where do you enter on the Malcolm thing. So one of the important things about the lost tapes is for a lot of people who are just being introduced to who this man is. And, of course, you know, not a day passes. There's not a news story about Malcolm X and some concept or some content. And so they need to understand exactly, first of all, that he was not a man of violence. You know, so often he's been mischaracterized as being someone who was just absolutely concerned, you know, about wiping out people. But he was talking about by any means necessary. It was usually a defensive measure. You know, if you're attacked, you know, you have to go ahead and resist. But I don't think he was ever talking about, you know, proposing and orchestrating any kind of a violent action because, you know, you look at ideologically and historically his perspective, none of that is present. And the lost tapes, I had a chance to see them several times now and shared the podium with John Kavanaugh, the producer out in Pittsburgh at the Heinz Center. And let me say this here quickly is that three of the things that I think the film needs to be further contextualized. There are the captions. You so much depends on the captions in terms of finding out that particular moment, what happens. But even there, you know, Shirley Graham Du Bois pops up. You don't know who she is. You got Gene Roberts leaning over a slain Malcolm. He's not explained because he is like an undercover agent with BOSS. Then you have another situation where, you know, I mean, so it's a number where Libert Bethune is there, who's interviewing Malcolm in Paris, and we don't understand, like, who are these young black people with Malcolm in Paris at that time? Well, so some of that stuff could be better contextualized.
Well, Marcus Hunter, I wonder if that gets to some of the other challenges of getting to know Malcolm X, is that he was so many different things to so many different people, and there are so many very polar views on Malcolm X, even today. I wonder what your read is of how well we understand his legacy.
Yeah, I think that what we can do, especially happy Black History Month to everyone, is that in this moment when we are rethinking and thinking about Black history, to think that Black politics, Black liberation, the Black freedom struggle is a multivocal experience. And I think part of what happens is he's often counterpoised against a voice, Martin Luther King, whose assassination we celebrate 50 years this Black History Month, as the sort of anti-everything relative to an inclusive Martin Luther King. And part of what we learn in the lost tapes is that to some degree, that's also Malcolm X's strategy to help Black people move forward by side after a while, presenting Martin Luther King as the most reasonable of us who are agitating against the system. So you best ought listen to him, because the rest of us will be less amenable to many of the things. I think one of the other major things that really stands out, particularly in a sort of hashtag Me Too moment, a hashtag Black Lives Matter moment, that's something he says in LA on May 20th, 1962, in Los Angeles, is that we need to start telling the white people how we really feel. That what he was trying to say is that there was this element in the civil rights movement that was in many ways masking the true feelings of black people as a way of saying, you know, if we let too much out, maybe we won't get anything. And what Malcolm X, I think, while his voice is still relevant today, is what he's letting us know is that if you settle, you still aren't heard. And when you hear people saying Me Too or Black Lives Matter, it's a echo of that same point that he was making, that if you just, you know, keep to yourself the trauma you feel or your lack of freedom, you're doing yourself ultimately a disservice in allowing America to convince itself that if we just give you the Voting Rights Act or the Civil Rights Act, you ought to then be feeling very happy because that's all you've really talked about. Mm-hmm. But instead, what he's saying is, no, people are angry about being murdered or watching murder or losing their parent or being bombed, that these things actually require a deeper understanding of the black experience.
Tom Jennings, I think Marcus kind of touched on one of the big aspects of the documentary, which, by the way, I should note, is less than an hour. So it's a very easy documentary to watch. But the contrast between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King comes out quite a bit. One of our listeners, Oblio, wrote on our website, the1a.org, Malcolm X was the antithesis of MLK. What else do we need to know about the guy? And Tom, I don't want to take the words out of your mouth, but that's not quite correct. They were not perfect antitheses. They were at odds, but they weren't polar opposites, certainly not for all of Malcolm X's life.
Well, certainly not toward the end of his life. That is for sure. I think in finding the footage for the lost tapes, one of the things that I was most surprised about was Malcolm's comments about the March on Washington in 1963, where, you know, when I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I went to, you know, I loved history classes, and I remember studying that march. And I'd never heard really much of a bad word said about it. And then you hear Malcolm X talking about how the march was pre-planned by white government officials in combination with the religious leaders at the time, and that instead of going to the Senate and the Capitol in the White House, they wound up going to the Washington Monument and then the Lincoln Memorial. And I was really surprised that Malcolm listed all of the things that he had a problem with for that 63 march. However, a year later, he was giving interviews to members of the media saying, you know, I've said some things in the past. One thing that I came to really respect the guy for that I didn't know much about was not only did he speak his mind, but if he felt that he had a change of heart, he had no problem saying, you know, I've tempered my thoughts on this, and I'm going to take a different course. And so, in one of the clips, we have him saying, "I hope that the leaders in the African American community can forgive me, and I certainly forgive them." And I found that amazing. You know, that I don't think the guy ever told a lie, you know, from what I could tell. And even when he was at odds, to, you know, further answer your question, they weren't polar opposites. They just, I think their goals were very similar. It's just how they went about getting there is what was different.
Skip wrote on our Facebook page, "I heard Malcolm speak at the University of Pennsylvania in the early 60s, one of the most inspiring speakers I've ever heard. I'll never forget the experience." And JB wrote on our website, "Maybe early on in his life when Malcolm X was affiliated with the Nation of Islam, but he eventually left that group, disavowed racism, and started to work with civil rights groups before his untimely assassination." Marcus, I know we have to pause in a minute, but I guess that's part of the challenge of understanding Malcolm X, is that he did change his views through the course of his life.
Exactly. He comes to a place, a phrase that I like to use often, especially in my classrooms, is that each of us needs all of us. You know, and I think that after his Hajj, by the time he comes back to give the ballot order bullet speech, which we focus on a lot in the book Chocolate Cities,
right,
he then has a more comprehensive understanding of the United States, so much so that he says, if you are below Canada, you're in the South.
Marcus, hold on to that thought for just 1 second. We have to pause in just a moment. We'll continue our conversation about the lost tapes of Malcolm X. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Simply Safe. Getting a good night's sleep is easier said than done, especially if you hear a noise downstairs. You could turn on all the lights and keep watch, or you can rest easy knowing that your home and family are protected with Simply Safe. Each Simply Safe system is a complete security arsenal. There are no contracts and no hidden fees. Get a special 10% discount when you order today at simplysafe.com/NPR1A.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to 1A. You know, we're always trying to improve, and there's a really easy way you could help us out. Just take a short, anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. It takes a few minutes, and you'll do us a huge favor at 1A by filling it out. Tell us what you like, what we could do better, online at npr.org/podcastsurvey. Thanks. I'm sorry, Marcus Hunter, you were making a point when we had to pause about Malcolm X and how he was changed after completing the Hajj, the ritual pilgrimage that all Muslims are required to take, all able-bodied Muslims are required to take once in their lifetime. Let me let you finish that thought and then we'll continue.
Yeah, so Zandria and I in the book Chocolate Cities extend from the ballot order bullet speech where he's in Detroit in April. And as Herb mentioned, he's giving the speech in Cleveland and Harlem and a lot of other chocolate cities.
And can you explain briefly, Marcus, what was that speech, the ballot or the bullet, for people who don't know?
Yes, so it was his campaign during the LBJ reelection season before black audiences, where he was offering up what is a more black nationalist platform. And he was basically saying that black, and in the form of black politics, the metaphor of the ballot and the bullet really stand in as the choices that black people often are faced with. You know, what to choose in an experiment that has not included you. You know, is it about self-defense? Is it about believing in the vote? And what he says is that we, one, really need to have a broader consciousness about where we are in the United States. And I think someone like him, especially related to Martin Luther King, who really did a lot of his freedom struggle work from the areas we would traditionally call the South, that Malcolm X offers something I think very poignant, because he's a child of the chocolate cities of the traditional North. So he's the place where the ideals are supposed to be manifested. That part of what makes America special is that there's this place called the North that looks better and does better by people than this place called the South. There he is in Michigan, and always most often rotating and migrating through the American North, feeling equally as oppressed, equally as devastated by the American experiment. And so he says it to affirmations and laughs, where what we try to say in a book is, you know, you're just up South or down South or West South or Mid South. And that's really born out of, I think, Malcolm X's very right, smart, critical articulation of a black geography of the United States, that black people are also doing this thing we call the Great Migration during this period the documentary covers. And what he's also speaking before audiences for whom dreams were unfulfilled. You go for a 100-mile journey to a brand new place called Chicago from the Mississippi Delta, and all of a sudden, all of the things about freedom still don't ring true. And who's speaking about that? And I think he's giving voice to an experience that otherwise is not being heard of because of the intention, what we see in the documentary as well, by media to really propagate and use and juxtapose Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X, so as to make one subversive Malcolm X and the other integrative or inclusive Martin Luther King. And what we learn is that neither is true about either.
Herb Boyd, let's talk a little bit more about the dynamic between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam. That's mm-hmm. a large part of the film. Here is a clip of the lost tapes, Malcolm X, with Malcolm X talking about being suspended from speaking publicly for at least 90 days. Listen.
Malcolm X, you were involved in a controversy some months ago with your leader.
Well, I've been silent for the past 90 days because of some statements I made concerning the President of the United States, which were distorted.
They were distorted?
And yes. And,
what did you say, Malcolm?
Well, I said the same thing that everybody says, that his assassination was the result of the climate of hate.
But
only I said the chickens came home to roost, and which means the same thing.
You feel that we're making progress in this
country? No. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. Mm-hmm. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that the blow made. And they haven't even begun to pull a knife out, much less try and heal the wound.
They won't
even admit the knife is there.
That's a clip of Malcolm X speaking to reporters after being silenced by Elijah Muhammad for 90 days after speaking after the assassination of JFK, as heard in the documentary The Lost Tapes, Malcolm X. Herb Boyd, there are kind of multiple things to unpack from that, but let's just focus for a minute on the relationship between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. I learned from the documentary a few things about the complexity of that relationship behind the scenes that don't really come out as much, say, if you've only seen the movie with Denzel Washington.
That's absolutely true, Josh. One of the things about this is that, you know, it's a kind of division. There's the, Malcolm in the NOI, the Nation of Islam, and then Malcolm after that. And I think one of the things that led up to his departure by March of 1964, and I think it was a gradual cumulative development there in terms of parting of the ways. In the mixtapes, for example, the opening statement, the opening speech from Malcolm was given out in L.A., after the death, the killing of Ron Stokes out there. And I think right away you get an indication that Malcolm was moving more and more into a political vein. And that was something that was frowned upon by Elijah Muhammad because he kept members of the Nation of Islam would not get involved in politics. And so you can see that even when you get to Ballad of the Bullet, and I think one of the telling metaphors coming out of that is when Malcolm says it's a choice between the wolf and the fox, between, you know, the fox being LBJ and the wolf being Goldwater at that time. But right away, he's beginning to mix politics more and more into his various rhetoric and speeches that he's giving around the country at that time.
Now, Herb, I hate to interrupt you, but I think when you say that, you know, Elijah Muhammad tried to keep out of politics, I think that might catch a lot of people by surprise. I mean, the Nation of Islam feels like an inherently political movement.
Well, it's a very conservative organization from a political standpoint because they didn't get involved in politics at all. In fact, you know, when the rebellion, for example, you take the rebellion that went down in Detroit in 1967, members of the Nation of Islam were standing on the sidewalk and telling people, you know, you're breaking the law, you know, and not to get involved in any of that. You know, when the elections came around, they didn't vote at all. They were not voting in the elections. So they were not involved in the electoral process. But there was something that Malcolm almost intuitively was beginning to feel that we needed to do. We need to speak out. And so after he left the Nation of Islam, you can see the evidence of that is clear, you know, right away. And of course, reaching out, toning down his attack on the so-called Big Six, you know, getting involved with members of the nation movement for change in this country in terms of human and civil rights movement. He was reaching out to these people. He had shared a podium with Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, in New York City later on before his assassination. He reached out to Coretta King down in Alabama. He spoke at the Brown Memorial Church down in Selma. So all of these things are indication that he was beginning to move more and more. He was kind of free of that political straitjacket, as he said on several occasions, that allowed him to kind of speak for himself. Because you notice that before leaving the Nation of Islam, he always prefaced his remarks according to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Thereafter, he kind of eliminated that completely from his speech. He was beginning to say, I'm articulating my own concerns, my own thinking. I'm not a mouthpiece for anyone. I'm not representative of the NOI. I'm representing the Organization of African American Unity or the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. I think it was an independent Malcolm at that time.
Right. One of our listeners was taken by some of the transition in the way that Malcolm X not only spoke, but was reflected in public at the time. One of our listeners emailed, "I am a white male, former military, convert to Islam, who had gone through a similar transition as Malcolm did with regard to racial relations. I love to read Malcolm's experience on the Hajj, the pilgrimage, and how it changed him, as it had changed me. My question is," and Tom, maybe you can answer this, "my question is, why did the latter peaceful Malcolm get covered much less by most of the media than the angry nationalist Malcolm with programs like the CBS series The Hate That Hate Created?" Tom, that's a documentary that Mike Wallace hosted that you include in your program, The Lost Tapes, clips of it.
Correct, yeah, which in and of itself is a remarkable thing when you watch it, because it's basically taking to task the Nation of Islam for, you know, its beliefs. It was made in 1959. It's a very good question, and unfortunately it's regarding why he Malcolm, was not covered as much. There is some truth in that. Unfortunately, it echoes through the decades to today. I mean, negative, angry statements often get the most attention in the press. And one of the things that I learned a lot more about was after the Hajj, he was taking what I think, and the other guests would be better spoken on this aspect of Malcolm, but he was working with the UN, or he was going to go to the United Nations and address race relations in the United States as a human rights issue instead of a civil rights, which would be dealing with laws in the South, for example. He wanted the world community to come and focus on what was happening in the United States, which I was not that familiar with that tactic that he took, but I thought I found it to be brilliant. But it was a softer touched Malcolm at the time, and it's a lot easier when he was saying really outrageous things to get headlines than instead of trying to cooperate.
Catherine wanted to know about the relationship between Malcolm X and Marcus Hunter. Maybe you can speak to this, about the relationship between Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali. Catherine says, from her hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. Marcus?
Yeah, I would just add on to, I know a lot of listeners have been echoing the autobiography of Alex Haley, but I would encourage listeners to read The Reinvented Life, Malcolm X Treatment by Manning Marable, who was a professor for me at Columbia University in African American Studies, because he really covers this, I think, with a greater detail, because you also have the opportunity of reflection. And what you find, I think, related to Muhammad Ali and to Elijah Muhammad, is that there's this sort of like internal struggle for power and representation. And Elijah Muhammad seems to feel relatively insecure about his protege in some ways stepping in front of him. So what we see very vividly depicted in the documentary is that using Muhammad Ali as a wedge in many ways. And I think, you know, once that happens, whereby Elijah Muhammad redubs Cassius Clay Muhammad Ali, which is the highest recognition that the organization could give at the time. Meanwhile, Malcolm X is still just Malcolm X without another name being bestowed on him, was very intentional. And I think it's then not by accident that what you see is a progenitor from Malcolm X of the hashtag MeToo movement, where he then makes what I think is a very painful confession that Elijah Muhammad has what amounts to a harem of teenage girls, that we might even say that he is in some ways, you know, the precursor for what we talk about today in Black politics and Black culture around R. Kelly. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very painful confession for him, that he in many ways, we see later, jeopardized his life, his career, his family, his residence, his property. And he didn't do that for personal gain. I think he did it because he was at a loss for a mentor whom he felt had brought him into the life, but was endangering young Black girls, was not necessarily forthcoming with the people who were his followers, was pushing a gender ideology that meant that women and men were separated in some sort of hierarchy.
Right,
and I think those kinds of gender dynamics added to his racial awakening really comprise a more reinvented Malcolm X, El-Haj, Malik El-Shabazz in a post-pilgrimage phase.
We're very low on time, but Herb, I would like to get your thoughts about the way that Malcolm X's family has tried to keep up his legacy. At the premiere for the documentary, we spoke with Ilyasa Shabazz, one of Malcolm X's daughters.
He was a man who had a strategy. You know, it wasn't about marching. It wasn't about making a lot of noise just for the sake of making a lot of noise. It was mobilizing people, understanding their human rights, understanding that if you continue to, that at some point we have to have a solution to all of these things. And my father presented solutions. And so it is up to us to come together, identify the problems, and do something about it once and for all, instead of sitting and just thinking that we're watching a movie.
That's Ilyasa Shabazz, one of the daughters of Malcolm X. Herb, we're super low on time, but I wonder your thoughts on the way that Malcolm X's family is preserving his legacy.
One of the things, I had an opportunity, and very privileged opportunity, to work with Ilyasa on the diary of Malcolm X. And what we did there was just go over the writings, that the diary he kept when he traveled across the North Africa and the Middle East and parts of Europe. And I think that captures the last year of his life. And I think that that's the most significant year, because he was politically maturated. Now he's to a level of understanding. And as you said earlier, Joshua, he's taken his issue, the African-American struggle in this country, to the world court and charging them with genocide, with the kind of racial oppression. So that was the kind of key point. And I think the daughters have done a remarkable job in carrying on his legacy. I think right now they're very, very much concerned with making sure that the licensing is controlled, the intellectual property is controlled.
Right.
So that's a key element in terms of carrying on Malcolm's legacy.
Herb Boyd, Tom Jennings, Marcus Hunter, thanks very much for talking with us. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.